Good morning. I sort of have a good crowd. Glad to see everybody that has made it out to the worship this morning. This month we have picked up on a theme of temptation. And so we've heard a lot of good lessons so far about the idea of temptation and the temptations that Jesus went through and what Joseph went through. And so I've entitled the lesson here this morning, A Closer Look at Overcoming Temptation. I'm going to pick the same stories that everybody else has been using. But sometimes I have a way maybe of looking at things a little bit differently. So I hope you've got your Bible with you, because with each one of our stories this morning, I have a verse or maybe a couple verses that I want you to highlight or underline a word that I think will help us as we try to navigate through temptation, because that's something that all of us are going to have to face. And not everybody's temptation is the same, and they're in differing degrees, but we all have to face temptation. We all have to fight different battles in our own mind when it comes to doing what is right and following the Word of God. For a verse I'll give you is a text, 1 Corinthians 10 and 13. This is the thing we need to remember. No temptation has overtaken you except such as common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. And that's a great promise that we have, that no matter how bad temptation is, we can overcome it. We can overcome the temptations, no matter how strong, no matter how powerful they are. So we have to look at how to do that and how we can overcome temptation. So I've got four little stories we're going to talk about this morning. I don't think this will be an overly long lesson. It's not really I guess on some degree it's not a very deep lesson, but in other ways it is, because we really have to study the words of what the scriptures are telling us. We're going to talk about Eve. We're going to talk about Joseph. We're going to talk about David. And we're going to talk about Jesus. And all of these have been referenced in recent lessons that we've heard. There's two positive examples on the list, and there's two negative examples. Two that were able to overcome temptation, and two that were not. So we're going to look at this lesson for a little while this morning, a closer look at overcoming temptation. Before we go further, though, let's go to God this time in a word of prayer. Let's begin our study this morning. You go all the way back to the beginning there in the Garden of Eden. We have the first temptation, and that involves Eve. Chapter 3, verse 1, Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field, which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, Has God indeed said, You shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, You shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die. Verse 4, Then the serpent said to the woman, You will not surely die. For God knows that in the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Genesis 3, 1 through 5. So if we think about this first temptation that is brought before Eve, as she's there in the Garden of Eden, we realize that the serpent's lying to her. I'll go ahead and eat it. Eat the fruit. Eat whatever you want to. You know, God just understands. And Eve has to make a decision. Before we talk about why Eve fell into temptation, I have a question for you. Why should Eve not have fallen into temptation? Can we think of a reason why Eve should not have fallen into temptation? And there's a very good answer. There's only one answer. Because God told her not to do it. And that's the only reason that she should have needed to not fall into temptation. God said, You shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die. Now, there's a verse that talks about one of the commandments being the first commandment with promise. Well, this is kind of another commandment with promise. And this was from the very beginning. God said, Here's what I want you to do. Here's what I don't want you to do. And there's a consequence. If you touch it, you will die. That is very clear. And that should have been the only reason to do what was right. You know I like Judge Judy. Judge Judy likes to say, if you tell the truth, you don't have to have a good memory. If you just say it, if you just do what is right. You know, sometimes there's only one reason to do something, and that's because it's right. It doesn't matter how many reasons there are to do it wrong. Sometimes there's just one reason, and that's enough. That's the reason that we do what is right, because that's what we were commanded to do. I don't care about the rest of the story. I don't care about anything else, because that's just going to get us all jumbled up. The bottom line is, This is what God told us to do, and that is the only reason we need to do it. We only need one, because God has commanded it. But what happened to Eve? Look at verse 6. When you get to this slide here, this horrible, when you see the one that's got the highlight, this is where I'd like you to take out your Bible. And we're going to kind of highlight some of these words, or underline them, because I think there's some real wisdom that's kind of hidden in the passage here. So here's verse 6. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And I kind of underlined three things, and I put some little numbers there. How many reasons did it take for Eve to do what was right? Well, it should have just been one, right? God told her what to do, and God told her what not to do. That's all that mattered, was that one thing. But all of a sudden now, you realize three things have popped up. Eve now has three reasons for why she did what was wrong. That's interesting. Here's another question for you. How do you tell the difference between a reason and an excuse? And I learned this very, very early on when I was coaching and teaching. I had a mentor tell me this. He said, especially when a kid wants to quit the team, if they come in and say, my daddy says I have to work, and that's all they say, that's a reason. And that's exactly why they're quitting, because their daddy said they had to work. But if they just come in and start rattling thing after thing, I mean just excuse after excuse after excuse, he said those aren't reasons, those are excuses. And that's a kid that you can't count on. And I've always remembered that. I remember that as I'm teaching. Where's your homework? If the kid says, well, I ran out of time and didn't do it, that's a reason. When they come up, well, you know, my dog ate it, and then my grandma got sick, and then I had to go into town and fix the car, and then the tornado hit. When they just start rattling things off one after another, it's no longer reasons. Those are excuses. And so I think about Eve in this situation. Why did Eve fall to the temptation of the serpent? Well, it's answered for us. There's three things that are listed. She says it's good for food, it was pleasant to the eyes, and it makes one wise. See how she had three reasons why she did something? You know, when we start doing this, this is what I like to call justifying. When we start trying to justify our actions, or justifying our inactions, and we always have a reason for why we did something or didn't do something, and we're real quick to list them and explain why we did something or why we didn't do something. When you notice yourself doing that, when you find yourself using multiple reasons to justify a decision, pretty good chances are you're slipping into temptation. And that's where you need to be careful. So if you notice yourself doing that, if we realize that we're justifying things, that we're making just reason after reason after reason, chances are we're slipping into temptation. We're falling into it. Okay? Because how many reasons do we need to do something that's right? One. If God tells us to do it, do it. If God says don't do it, then don't do it. We need one reason, that's it. So when we start trying to justify it, we pile up 5, 6, 7 reasons, kind of like Eve did here. She had three reasons for it. When we start piling up our reasons and start trying to justify our actions, chances are we are falling into temptation. I can't help but also think back to this verse, which was discussed here in the recent weeks. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And that's exactly what John talks about in 1 John 2 and 16. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. So we need to be careful when we start trying to justify things. That sometimes we try to convince ourselves, even though we're doing something wrong, we can convince ourselves that it's okay. We can find a way in our mind to twist it just right where it sounds good. Don't do that. When we realize that we're starting to have excuses, yeah, that's a problem. We're probably falling into temptation. So I'm going to give you four principles this morning of overcoming temptation based off of each one of our stories. So here's the first one from the story of Eve. You only need one reason to do what is right. You only need one reason to do what is right. Multiple reasons usually accompany a poor decision. So keep that in mind as we face temptation in our lives. Second story is little Joseph. Joseph is one of the most interesting people that we'll ever find his account told in the scripture. There's so much in the book of Genesis, too, that is delegated here to Joseph. His story that we're looking at this morning is told in Genesis chapter 39. And Remember, Joseph has made his way from being the boy in the multicolored coat, in the coat of many colors, and he was sold into slavery, and he's found his way there to Egypt. And the next thing you know, he's worked his way up. He's the number two man in all of Egypt. He's working there for Potiphar. But there was a little bit of a problem that Potiphar had a wife. And Potiphar's wife had eyes for old Joseph, and Joseph was a very good-looking and handsome young man. Genesis chapter 39. Verse 7, and it came to pass, after these things, that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused. Skip down here to verse 10. So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. So this is an ongoing issue, Potiphar's wife flirting and trying to seduce old Joseph. It just keeps going day after day after day. I got a question for you. If Potiphar's wife was the aggressor, why did Joseph need to take any responsibility for the situation in the first place? Right? It wasn't Potiphar's fault. He wasn't doing it. It wasn't Joseph's fault. He wasn't doing anything wrong. It was Potiphar's wife. She was the one that was coming after him. So why should Joseph have to take any responsibility whatsoever for this situation? Well, he's going to answer that question in verse 9 of Genesis chapter 39. Joseph says, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? It didn't matter whose fault it was. It didn't matter who started it. It was a sin against God. And Joseph didn't want to have any part to do with Potiphar, with Potiphar's wife, or with this illicit affair. He had no desire to be around him. So Joseph made some pretty wise decisions. Joseph realized something. He realized that sin was very near to him in that house. That temptation was right around the corner. And Joseph knew he better be aware of his surroundings. He better not put himself in a bad situation. He better be aware of his surroundings. So here we go. This is the verse I want you to notice here, underline, highlight, kind of some key words here in Genesis 39, 11, and 12. It says, but when it happened about this time, when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. And I kind of highlighted here, underlined, none of the men of the house were inside. Thought about that before? Joseph and Potiphar's wife, this whole little dynamic, it said was going on every day. I don't know how long it had lasted, but Potiphar's wife was pretty persistent. It said she just kept on and kept on and kept on. Well, then we have here in Genesis chapter 39 and verse 11, it says, none of the men of the house were inside. I think that's important. I think that's significant. And since the absence of the men is mentioned, it appears to me that was not normal. It was not usual, or it wouldn't have needed to be mentioned in the scriptures. That tells me that Joseph was probably using a little bit of common sense. I have a feeling Joseph probably made sure that there was somebody else always in the house. And I have a feeling Joseph probably made sure of his schedule that there was always others so that he would never be found alone with Potiphar's wife. If not, I don't think he'd have said that phrase there. None of the men of the house were inside. There's something special about this one incident. And I kind of have a tendency, I think Terry said this last week, it wouldn't surprise me at all if Potiphar's wife had something to do with the men not being in the house. It wouldn't surprise me at all. But I want you to realize how Joseph paid attention to his surroundings. Again, going back to teachers, pretty much the first thing you're taught as a teacher, don't ever be in a room with the door shut with a student. That's just good business practice. Don't ever find yourself in that situation. Whether there's anything happening or not, it's appearances. It doesn't look right, and it leads to situations. Always have your door open. Or if you're going to have a meeting with a kid that you're not too sure about, always have another teacher or another adult in the room. And I suppose that goes for pretty much business practices everywhere. You have a witness. You don't want to get into a situation where things don't look right and where it can turn into a he said, she said kind of situation. Be careful of your surroundings. And I think Joseph learns it. And I think Joseph teaches that. Don't ever put yourself in a compromising situation that could lead to temptation. Be smart. Be smart about what we do. Be smart about what tempts us. You know, 1 Thessalonians 5:22, Paul says, abstain from every form of evil. That's pretty good advice. Now, right now, I'm not going to step on your toes. I'm going to let you step on your own toes. Because everyone in this room has a temptation. Everyone has something that causes our mind to stray, that tempts us to doing sin, that tempts us to do wrong. Everyone has it. So right now, I want you to think about it. I want you to think about what it is that you know in your heart of hearts, and maybe nobody else knows it, but you know in your heart of hearts what bothers you, what tempts you, what might cause you to sin. Everybody knows it. Think about it. And I want you to think about it. Do you typically put yourself in a situation where you're surrounded by that temptation? I hope not, because if we do, we're most likely going to fall into it. Let me give you just a blanket example here. Let's say I am greatly tempted by gambling. Gambling just really gets me going, and it causes me to do crazy things. Well, then I would not suggest me taking a vacation to Las Vegas. That just doesn't make sense. We don't want to surround ourselves with what tempts us. We want to get as far away from it as possible. Paul says, abstain from every form of evil. Think about your surroundings. Think about your situation. Whatever it is that tempts you, don't have it around you. Plan ahead. Plan accordingly. Be smart so that you don't find yourself into that situation. I think that's what Joseph did. He made sure that there was always someone else in the house so he wouldn't be tempted to find himself with Potiphar's wife. But old Potiphar's wife was pretty smart. If it was her that was kind of pulling the strings. Because there was a situation where Joseph found himself alone with the woman. If you do get in that situation, learn from Joseph. Get out as fast as you possibly can. Get out quick. Paul said in 2 Timothy 2:22, flee also youthful lust, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace. And Joseph is the poster child for this because he did flee. He literally fled. He ran. Remember, Potiphar's wife was left holding his robe. And that kind of turned into the evidence that was used to convict Joseph and get him sent into prison. But Joseph did. He ran. He completely got himself out of the situation. I think there's wisdom in that. Here's our first principle from Eve. Remember, you only need one reason to do what's right. And if you have multiple reasons, you're probably wrong. Well, here's our second one from Joseph. Always be aware of your surroundings to keep yourself away from temptation as much as you can. If we find that we're tempted from something, try to stay away from it. Don't see how close we can get to it. Plan ahead. Be smart. See what the situation's going to be. If you know you're tempted by alcohol, then don't go to a party where you know they're going to be serving alcohol. Things like that. Be smart. Always try to plan accordingly. I think that's the lesson from Joseph. Our third story comes from 2 Samuel chapter 11. This is David. So we talked recently about David and Bathsheba. David had everything. He was rich. He was powerful. He was a leader of men. He was a leader of a nation. He had everything he could possibly ever want in his life. 2 Samuel 11:1. And it happened in the spring of the year, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. 2 Samuel 11:1. And that gives us now the introduction to the story that we all know, the story of David and Bathsheba. Well, I got a thought now. So here's it. The nation of Israel is in the middle of a war. It's in the middle of a military conflict against these foreign nations. Shouldn't that have had the king's attention? Shouldn't the king have been pretty concerned about his armies that were off fighting? Shouldn't that have been a sobering mindset, you would think, for the king when there's people all fighting and dying on his behalf? I would think so. I think this should have been enough reason right here for David to be serious-minded, have a very serious mindset. His troops are engaged in battle. People are dying for his cause. Should have been enough for David to take things pretty seriously. But I don't think David was in a real serious mindset. I don't think David really had his faculties engaged. Because we read the next verse, and here you go. Here's one we're going to highlight here. 2 Samuel 11:2. And then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house. So here we go. I highlighted in the evening that David arose from his bed. Here's my question. Why was the king lying on his bed in the evening? What was he doing? Laying down, taking a nap in the evening? He's the king. His country's in the middle of a war. And here the king is laying down, taking a nap, I guess. Now, I get it. I like to lay down and take a nap. I do. Especially when I can get up early and have those early morning practices, and then I have to go to teacher in service or school or something like that, and then I get home about 4 or 5 o'clock, yeah, I'm probably going to take a nap. But that's because I'm tired. I don't think David was tired. And I prove it to you, too. I don't think David was tired. But why was the king lying on his bed in the evening? What was he doing? Why wouldn't he out, you know, attending to the affairs of the state? Well, I think it's because he was bored. I think it was because he was disengaged. He was inactive. He got lazy. Afraid. I don't think he was tired because he's about to have a whole lot of energy just like that. So I don't think he was tired. As soon as he saw Bathsheba, he was no longer tired. So I don't think it was a physical thing. I think it was a mental thing. He was bored. He was disengaged. He was inactive. And so there's David, the great king that's got everything he could ever possibly want, laying on the bed in the middle of the evening. My next question, why did David fall into temptation? Well, I think it's because he was bored. I think it's because he was disengaged. And I think he's inactive. And I think there's a lesson that we could learn from that. Yeah, I don't think he was tired. I think when he saw Bathsheba, you know, he perked up pretty quickly when he saw that pretty lady down there. It wasn't physical. He was in his head. Now, I can also give you some other evidence here. David started asking questions. Remember, this is the king. This is the king whose armies are in battle right now. Who did David inquire of in order? You ever thought about that? So go back to 2 Samuel, the 11th chapter, and it says that David inquired of several people. Here's the order. Number one, he inquired about Bathsheba. That was the first person he was concerned with. In verse 3, the Bible tells us that he looked down and he saw this very beautiful woman bathing there. And it says he sent someone right then and there to inquire of Bathsheba. She was first. Well, after he got himself into trouble, he called for his general, Joab. And it says in verse 7 that he inquired of Joab. Joab, how you doing? Then he inquired about the people. How are the people doing? How are the armies doing? How are people holding up? Then finally he inquires about the war. How's the war going? So he went Bathsheba, Joab, the armies, finally the war. Doesn't he have his priorities misplaced? Doesn't that sound upside down? If you were the leader of an army or leader of a country, shouldn't it have been the other way around? Shouldn't he first have inquired, hey, how's the war going? How are my soldiers doing? How are the people doing? Joab, are you doing okay yourself? And then worry about Bathsheba there at the end. You see, David had all of his priorities twisted because he's sitting around the house doing nothing all day long, I'm afraid. He was sitting around his bed. He didn't have anything to do. When we get inactive, that's when we have a tendency to get ourselves into trouble. That's when temptation comes, when we don't have anything to do. Here's our third principle. So we got Eve's, we have Joseph's principle, here's David's principle. Keep yourself busy. Keep your time occupied. When we sit around and have nothing to do, that's probably when we're going to get into trouble. And I've seen this quote here, idle hands are the devil's tools. I've also seen it, idle hands are the devil's workshop. I think there's a lot of truth to that. When we don't have a lot of things to do, that's when we have a tendency to get into trouble. And that's when we have a tendency to fall into temptation. Keep busy. I wish old David had kept himself busy. But instead, all he had to do was lay around until the middle of the afternoon and then walk around and see Bathsheba and then go talk to Bathsheba. It's not what he should have been doing. He got himself into problems because he had allowed himself to lose interest. Finally, we have our story of Jesus. This comes from Matthew chapter 4. So this is the temptations of Jesus. It says, then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterward he was hungry. Now when the tempter came to him, he said, if you are the Son of God, command these stones to become bread. But he answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Verse 5. And then the devil took him up into the holy city, set him up on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge over you, and in their hands he shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Jesus said to him, it is written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. Verse 8. And again, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. And Jesus said to him, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve. And then the devil left, and behold, angels came and ministered to him. Matthew 4, verses 1 through 11. Now we've heard that story many times. Heard it taught last week, the idea of the temptations of Jesus. So again, I got a question for you. What reply did Jesus give to the devil upon each of the temptations? Well, he kept using the phrase, it is written. In fact, he said it three times. Verse 4, verse 7, and verse 10, it is written. I think there's a lesson there we need to know. That we should only concern ourselves with what the Scriptures say. We don't need to worry about opinions. We don't need to worry about what is socially or politically correct. We need to worry about what the Scriptures say. And every time there's a temptation, Jesus replied, it is written. As it is written, it is written. What the Scriptures tell us, that's what should be guiding us. And that should be what keeps us out of temptation. I know that's easy to say, and sometimes it is to do, because temptations can be so strong. But I want you to really look closely at a couple verses here. So there's my highlight. Matthew 4, Matthew 5, and Matthew 8. I'm sorry, Matthew 4, verse 3, verse 5, and verse 8. I want you to notice these three words. It says, now when the tempter came. And then down to verse 5. Then the devil took him. And finally, verse 8, and again the devil took him. And so when I started reading those, I noticed those words really start popping in my mind. Because to me, that teaches that there's a progression. This is not just something that happened. The devil has a plan. The devil has a progression. It was when, then, and again. I find that interesting. When, that means it's inevitable. The devil's going to come after each and every one of us. It is inevitable. He is going to come after us and tempt us. Then, he's going to come back again. Again, he's going to come back a third time and a fourth time. And he's going to keep coming back until we show that we can resist him. And I think that's important. And I think Jesus realizes. He knew the progression and he was able to withstand it. Now, I really like this verse from James 4 and 7. Therefore, submit to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. There is a promise. It doesn't say he's going to flee from you the first time. It doesn't say we're only going to be tempted once, and then we're done with it. No, he's going to come again and again and again. When the tempter comes, it's inevitable. Then, he's got a second part, and he's going to come back again. But we have a promise now. It's when, then, again, and finally, the devil's going to flee. I think that's a great little lesson to remember. When, then, again, and flee. The devil will leave eventually, but not if we keep giving in to the temptation. If we keep giving into it, the devil's going to make a house right beside us. So we better be careful of that. So when we realize that we're in the midst of temptation, that's okay. We need to understand we're getting through it because it's a progression. Just like the devil had a progression and a game plan against Jesus, he's got a game plan against us. So if we want to get through it, we just got to keep fighting. We can't give in to it, or that gives the devil a foothold in our lives. Here we go, our last principle. All right, we got Eve up here. You only need one reason to do what's right. That's it. And if you have multiple reasons, chances are you're probably wrong, and we're probably falling into temptation. Then we have Joseph. Be aware of your surroundings. Make sure that we're keeping ourselves away from temptation as much as possible, as much as on our half. Let's try to keep the temptations away from us. Then we got David's principle. Keep yourself busy. Keep your hands and your time occupied. And that will keep us from falling into temptation. And now finally we have Jesus' principle. Understand that the game plan of the devil is a carefully thought out process. And we need to understand that. And if the devil has a game plan, we need to have a game plan. And we have to understand that we're going to be tempted. It's going to happen. We're going to be tempted again and again and again and again until we show that we can resist. But when we resist the devil, we have a promise that he will flee. And there's our closer look at temptation. So we've got four stories. The story of Eve in the garden, Joseph and Potiphar's wife, David and Bathsheba, and the temptations of Jesus. Temptations are such a difficult thing to try to overcome. And we talk about reading and studying and praying, but I want to take a little bit closer look. I think there's some real key little words in those passages. So highlight them, underline them, think about them a little bit, because I think there's some insight that we can learn from the words of the Scripture. So hopefully this lesson maybe give us some encouragement. I'm telling you, we all are going to face temptation. And the way we come out of it is going to determine what type of life that we live here and our eternity as well. So I'll leave the thoughts with you this morning. We'd ever like to close, though, without having a song of invitation. If we can help you in any way, we stand ready to assist you this time.